to support this NPR station.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the program that formerly was hosted by Eve Prang Plews. Eve passed away 2 weeks ago. Very sad. WMNF is very sad about that. All of us here at MNF mourn the passing of Eve Prang Plews. This is a program that has a long history on WMNF. We've done a lot of health and nutrition programs. So in the next few weeks, we're going to hear varying kinds of health and nutrition programs in Eve's former slot. Of course, Eve Prang Plews's programs still exist on our website. You can go and hear the archives of all the great shows that Eve did over the years. You can go to wmnf.org/listen and listen back to the shows every other Monday at 10 a.m. John Butts will be back this coming Monday, next Monday at 10 o'clock. But today we're going to hear a program that comes to us from KPFA in San Francisco and the Northern California area. It is hosted by Mitch Jesrich, and it's all about nutrition. This program is. It's a interview with Robert Lustig, who is one of the noted critics of sugar. Lustig is an MD, a pediatrician. We're going to hear a little bit more about his background. But how dangerous is sugar? That's the topic coming up right now on 88.5 FM. And this program is one of the great programs that we carry on our HD3 channel, The Source. We're bringing it over to our main channel today. This is one of the great interviews that Mitch Jesrich has ever done. Let's listen in.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
this is a war. This is a war.
Well, you're threatening their profits. At least you're studying.
Well, you see, the thing is, I don't want to threaten their profits.
Yeah.
Okay? They don't care what they sell, as long as they sell.
Right.
They really don't care what they sell. They've told me so. Directly. They said, we don't care what we sell. We just can't lose money.
Yeah.
Because they have Wall Street profits and quarterly reports and stockholders and blah, blah, blah. And that's how they decide, you know, how they, the stockholders decide who keeps, you know, the executive jobs, et cetera. So they can't go against the stockholders. Their job is to make money, and they will make money any way they can.
Robert Lustig is a professor of pediatrics and endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco, where he's also the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program. He is a leading voice taking on the food industry, and he'll join us to talk about that fight next on Letters in Politics. Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jesrich. The battle over the so-called soda tax is likely to heat up in the California city of San Francisco this year. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors are close to putting on the November ballot a 2 cent per ounce tax on sugary beverages, with the funds dedicated to health, nutrition, and physical activity programs. This comes after the state of New York failed to pass a similar measure a few years ago, and the California city of Richmond also failed with such an endeavor in 2012. In 2009, the Obama administration explored levying an excise tax on sweetened beverages as part of healthcare reform efforts, but the proposal was abandoned after heavy lobbying by the beverage industry. There was a significant victory for such a tax internationally in Mexico last year. Proponents of a soda tax argue that added sugar to store-bought beverages is helping drive the obesity epidemic, not just in this country, but around the world. Opponents claim that such a tax restricts choice and that the dangers of sugar are greatly exaggerated. Today we're going to be in conversation about the science of sugar. My guest is Dr. Robert Lustig. Dr. Robert Lustig is a professor of pediatrics and endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. He's director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at UCSF. He's also president of the Institute for Responsible Nutrition. You could check more about that online at responsiblefoods.org. He's the author of a number of books, including Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Also, Sugar has 56 names, and his latest book is The Fat Chance, cookbook. Dr. Robert Lustig, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the station.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
I would like to begin by asking you about our notion of obesity and also our notions of calorie. The idea that so many of us have is to stay trim or to stay fit is that you'll consume so many calories and then you also have to burn those calories. Excess calories end up being added on as fat.
That's the standard mantra. It's been going on for many years. It's based on the first law of thermodynamics, which says that the total energy inside a closed system remains constant. In human terms, there are two interpretations. The standard interpretation, the one that I learned, the one that you learned, the one you just espoused, is if you eat it, you better burn it or you're going to store it. And if that's true, then the weight gain is secondary to two behaviors. Eating
and exercising.
Exercising. Gluttony and sloth, if you will.
Right. Which most people think.
And that's what most people think.
That's what I thought.
That's what virtually everyone thinks. There's a second interpretation. You know that every law is subject to interpretation. The Supreme Court has shown us that. There's another way to say the law. It's just as compelling, and in fact, it's the true version. And that is, if you're going to store it, that is biochemical forces that drive energy deposition, most of which are outside of your control, and you expect to burn it, that is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, because energy expenditure and quality of life are synonymous. Things that make your energy expenditure go up make you feel good, like ephedrine off the market, caffeine for 2 hours, exercise. Things that lower your energy expenditure make you feel lousy, like hypothyroidism, starvation. Are actually secondary to a biochemical process. The biochemistry drives the behavior. And we have shown this in several paradigms, human paradigms, and of course, we've known about these in animal studies since time immemorial. The point is, if there is a biochemical process going on that's driving obesity, driving weight gain, driving chronic metabolic disease, then trying to deal with the outcomes of that biochemical process, that is, getting people to diet and exercise, is basically attacking the wrong problem. It's working way downstream. It's better to deal with the cause than the effect. And that's what we do. That's what my clinic does at UCSF. The primary driver of energy deposition is the hormone insulin. Insulin is the energy storage hormone. Insulin shunts sugar to fat. Insulin makes fat. More insulin, more fat. Well, we are now releasing 2 to 3 times more insulin than we did 50 years ago, based on studies, historical controls. Everyone is hyperinsulinemic today. And we have shown that the higher your insulin goes, the less well your brain gets the satiety signal called leptin. Leptin is a hormone that's made from your fat cells, goes to your brain and tells your brain, hey,
you've
I've had enough.
Yeah.
But insulin gets in the way of that. So the higher your insulin goes, the more energy gets stored and the hungrier you get. Well, if you're storing energy, you don't want to burn it and you get very hungry. And so there's your vicious cycle of consumption and disease. Now, the problem is if that's what's going on, you're leptin resistant. You're not seeing your leptin. Then you try to diet, and now your fat cells start to wither, and your leptin goes down. Now you're leptin deficient, and that's what we see. That's the recidivism of obesity. That's what we see going on in all of these yo-yo dieters, is they try to lose weight, and they can't, and they end up overeating to compensate because now they have two biochemical problems instead of one.
It's an addiction?
Well, in fact, there is data that suggests that certain foodstuffs, in particular the one we're going to talk about, sugar, is addictive in the same way alcohol is, in the same area of the brain. Not in everyone, but in enough people that it's a problem, and it causes the same neurochemical changes that drive reward, tolerance, and withdrawal, and psychological dependency. Bottom line, it's abused.
Yeah.
Whether it's addictive or not is irrelevant. It's abused. It's both toxic and abused. And that makes it rife for societal intervention, of which a tax would be one.
Let me ask you this then. If we go back to that model of calorie intake and burning calories, if you had enough exercise, had a regular calorie intake of 2,000 calories a day, and I don't know if even that's a good model anymore or not, but let's just say 2,000 calories a day. If a majority of your calories to that 2,000 calories was from sugar, would it be harder to lose weight?
Absolutely.
If that's what you're trying to do?
Absolutely.
Then if you had 2,000 calories that weren't majority of sugar?
Look, the first law is a law. If it's a closed system, that is, if you're eating 2,000 calories and you're burning 2,000 calories, then you're going to stay weight stable because you don't glean it from the air. But we're not closed systems. We're biological systems. We are not, bomb calorimeters. We don't just blow up the calories that we consume. There are metabolic systems in our body that take care of different calories in different ways. So the concept that the amount of calories that you eat can be offset by the amount of calories that you burn is actually pretty naive. In fact, we don't do that. The question is, what drives more energy into fat than other things? And the answer is, anything that makes your insulin go up is going to do that. And there are two things on our docket that are particularly egregious in this respect. Refined carbohydrate, which of course is everything, and sugar, which of course is everything. Those are the two things. And refined carbohydrate, glucose, does it by causing the pancreas to release more insulin. And fructose, the sweet molecule in sugar, does it by going to your liver, turning into liver fat in your liver, and therefore making your liver sick so that your pancreas has to make more insulin to make the liver do its job. Two separate phenomena, one called insulin release, the other one called insulin resistance. Bottom line, you put them together, and that's what sugar is, and now your insulin levels are super high, and now you're driving energy into fat tissue, you're gaining weight, it's affecting your reward system, you're not getting enough reward, you keep on eating, and you drive all of the chronic metabolic diseases in its wake.
Tell me about the science of how sugar works on the body. And of course, we need sugar.
No, we don't.
Not at all?
Not at all. That is a huge misconception. In fact, it's a downright lie. Huh. We do not need sugar.
Glucose?
We need glucose, but we can make it. In fact, the people on ketogenic or Atkins-like diets, they're not consuming much glucose at all. Your liver makes glucose. It makes it very well. If you're not consuming any glucose, your liver will make all the glucose it needs. So the concept that you need sugar is true, but you don't need dietary sugar. You need it from your liver. There are really only four things you need. You need essential amino acids. The rest of the amino acids can be made. There are 9 of those, but there are 20 amino acids. The other 11 can be made. You need essential fatty acids. For instance, oleic acid. You need palmitic acid. You need DHA and EPA, mm-hmm. which are omega-3s. You need those because we can't make those. And then we need vitamins and we need minerals. That's really all we need. Everything else we can make. Oh, and by the way, we need water.
Yeah.
Yeah, can't make that. So those are the things we need. After that, everything else is manufacturable. So do we need glucose? The answer is no. We need to make it. We don't need to eat it. And do we need fructose? Do we need the sweet molecule in sugar? There is not one biochemical reaction in any vertebrate, in any mammal that requires dietary fructose. None. Zero. Zilcho. Nada. It is a storage form of sugar in plants. It's one of the things that happened when plants differentiated from eukaryotes, from, animals. The bottom line is fructose is vestigial. It's irrelevant. It's an energy source. It is not nutrition. It never was. But the food industry wants to make it nutrition because they want to put it in everything and say it can be part of a balanced diet.
So actually, when we look at the label, when we look at labels and we see fructose in there, what are they doing? Are they separating it from the entire sugar?
Well, there's something called sugar, which is a combination of glucose, fructose bound together. That's cane sugar, beet sugar, table sugar, the stuff you put in your coffee. There's something called high fructose corn syrup, where the glucose and the fructose are not bound together. They're free in solution, in a syrup. There's other natural sweeteners like honey, which is sucrose, like maple syrup, which is sucrose, like agave syrup, which is sucrose, but with a little bit extra fructose. It's about 75% fructose. And then, of course, there's crystalline fructose that's made in a laboratory that can be added to foods. That was just sanctioned by the European Food Safety Authority as being safe. It is anything but. So those are all of the options that the food industry has to try to sweeten foods specifically to get us to buy more.
Is there a difference between natural sugars that you get in fruit and processed sugars?
No, they're exactly the same.
They're the exact same thing.
Exactly the same. The difference is that in fruit, you get the requisite dose of fiber. However much fructose there is in fruit, there's an equal amount of fiber to offset it. Look at the thing that has the most fructose of anything on the planet, sugarcane. It's a stick.
Yeah.
Okay? You can't even chew the damn thing.
No, it's hard.
Okay? And if you did a scattergram of fructose on one side versus fiber on the other side, it would be a nice diagonal line, and virtually every fruit would live along that lines. You know, so lemons, you know, have very little fructose and a little less fiber, and then you go all the way up, you know, to sugar cane with a lot of fructose and a lot more fiber. Bottom line, the fiber is there to protect you. The fiber acts as a gel on the inside of your intestine. The soluble, insoluble fiber, it's like a hair catcher on the bathtub drain. It, when the hair catcher is down, the little plastic lattice work with the little holes in it, and then the hair fills up the holes, it forms a barrier and doesn't let the water go down. In your intestine, when you have the soluble and insoluble fiber together, it forms this gel, which then prevents sugar and fats, for that matter, absorption, so that the liver doesn't get it all at the same time, so that the liver stays healthy because it has a chance to metabolize it. In addition, a lot of the nutrients and a lot of the sugar will go further down the intestine where the bacteria are. You know, each of us is 10 trillion cells.
Yeah.
But we have 100 trillion bacteria in our intestine. Each of us is really just a big bag of bacteria with legs. The point is, they got to eat something. The question is, what do they eat? Well, they eat what you eat. The question is, how much did you get versus how much did they get? And the goal is for them to get more. This is another reason why a calorie is not a calorie, why it depends on what those calories are. Because if those calories come with fiber, that means the bacteria are going to get more and you're going to get less, and that's good for weight maintenance. As opposed to if there's no fiber, which is what processed food is, you're going to get the whole onslaught, in which case you're going to drive your insulin way up, and you're going to drive energy into fat, and you're going to start the bad process.
In your very popular video, The Bitter Truth of Sugar, you call it what, fart or fat?
Fat or fart, yeah.
Fat or fart.
That's right. That's right. And the reason is because those bacteria can metabolize those nutrients that are brought further down the intestine. And some of those bacteria do make some hydrogen sulfide. And, you know, that's, you know, actually, in a way, from a weight standpoint, that's kind of good. From a social standpoint, that's another story.
So if somebody has a fresh squeezed glass of orange juice, and I'm not talking about store-bought, but took five oranges and squeezed them, is that as bad as processed food?
Absolutely.
As bad.
My colleague, Cindy Gershon, who is the chef of the Fat Chance Cookbook, is the food teacher at Mount Diablo High School. And the first day, every season, she runs the same experiment in her class. She takes two kids. She hands each kid six oranges. She says to the first kid, "Here, kid, here's six oranges. Make juice." Kid squeezes the six oranges, gets about 12 and a half ounces. Kid downs the 12 and a half ounces, says, "Okay, what's for breakfast?" She says to the second kid, "Here, kid, here's six oranges. Eat the six oranges." Kid eats orange number one, orange number two, orange number three. Gets to orange number four and throws
up. Just can't
do
it.
Yeah. Throws up. Says, "I'm going to die."
Yeah.
Okay. What happened? The fiber happened. The fiber mitigated the negative effects, number one, by reducing rate of absorption, and number two, by providing the satiety signal sooner so that you couldn't eat all those oranges. But when you turn it into juice,
Right.
Game over.
Just goes right there.
That's right.
And fast food is fiberless?
That's what
no
fast
fiber
food is.
At all?
That's it. They take it out because you can't freeze fiber. Go home, take an orange, put it in your freezer overnight. Take it out next morning, put it on your counter, let it thaw, try to eat it, see what you get. You get mush. Why do you get mush? The ice crystals damage the cell wall, macerate the cell wall, so that the water rushes in so that it turns to mush. Mm-hmm. Now, food industry knows that. So what do? They take the fiber out.
They take the fiber out.
Absolutely. Squeeze it, freeze it, lasts forever.
A lot
forever.
Of people think of fiber with the structure of food.
That's right. And that's good.
You still have structure in fast food, I suppose.
Not really. Try. Yeah. Go look at what, you know, I mean, the only, other than the lettuce in a McDonald's salad, yeah. Go look for fiber in a fast food item. It doesn't exist. And that's in part so that they can ship it around the world, so that it's consistent place to place, and so that it's not mushy and gushy when you thaw it or fry it up.
Listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. After this quick musical break, we'll return to our conversation with Dr. Robert Lustig, professor of pediatrics and endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. Still to come, we'll talk about his fight with the food industry. Stay tuned.
You're listening to this interview with Dr. Robert Lustig on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM.
Conversation with Dr. Robert Lustig, professor of pediatrics and endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also director of the Weight Assessment of Teen and Child Health Program at the university. Furthermore, he's president of the Institute for Responsible Nutrition. You find more at responsiblefoods.org. He's written several books, including Fat Chance, Sugar Has 56 Names, and a new cookbook called The Fat Chance Cookbook. So in preparing for our conversation, I started looking at the ingredients of everything in my house, and I was looking for sugars in particular.
Well, and, there are 56 names.
Exactly. And I had frozen Trader Joe's, but I don't know if that even matters, frozen burritos in my freezer. And I looked back and I said, okay, three grams of fat, or of sugar, excuse me, 3 grams of sugar. Doesn't sound that bad.
So the question is, why is there sugar in a burrito? Give me a reason.
Is it not naturally in there somewhere?
Can you tell me why there's sugar in a burrito? Now, I will tell you. Uh-huh. I will tell you that, you know, I have investigated these things, mm-hmm. and of the various food purveyor options, Trader Joe's actually has the least amount of sugar of any commercially available food procurement offering.
Right.
So I don't want to pick on Trader Joe's. Okay, I mean, if you went and looked at the burritos,
Safeway,
it's way worse.
Interesting.
But the fact is, why do you need sugar in a burrito?
Why do you need sugar in a burrito?
You tell me.
Because I'm more likely to enjoy it, the taste of it, and I'm more likely to buy it. Pure economics.
Bottom line, there are 5 tastes on your tongue.
Yeah.
There's salty, bitter, sour, umami, like soy sauce or roast beef, and sugar, sweet. Sweet covers up the other 4.
Salt.
Covers up salt. That's honey roasted peanuts or Chex Mix. Covers up bitter. Milk chocolate, right? Cocoa's bitter. Covers up umami, sweet and sour pork. You know, I mean, that's half soy sauce. You wouldn't eat that, except that you can't even tell once the sugar's been added. And it covers up sour, lemonade, or the Swiss Reserve in German wines, because there's so much citric acid, because there's not enough sun. So it doesn't turn into sugar to turn it into alcohol. It stays as acid, you know, like vinegar. That's why, you know, they put sugar in the balsamic vinegar to try to cut it also. Bottom line, you can make dog poop taste good with enough sugar, and the food industry does.
So back to the burritos. And if sugar has 56 different names, is there probably more sugar in those burritos and say the 3 grams that it listed?
No, probably that's what that's probably what it is. The question is, how much, when you see on the side of the food label, total sugars, how do you know whether that's the sugar that was endogenously in the food itself, or whether it's milk sugar, by the way, neither of which are a problem, or whether it's specifically added sugar, added by the food industry specifically for its own purposes, not for yours.
Yeah.
You don't know. You're not allowed to know. And there's a reason you're not allowed to know, because the 1990 Nutrition Labeling and Education Act that the FDA, you know, follows, prior to the passage of that act, the food industry went to the FDA and said, if we told people exactly how much sugar we put in all the foods, our competitors could duplicate our recipes. This is proprietary information, and you're not allowed to know it. You know what the FDA said? They said, oh, okay. So when you see the number of grams of total sugars, you can't figure out what's what and what was put there specifically. There are ways to figure it out. There are methods. Like, for instance, my favorite example of this is yogurt. So, you think yogurt's healthy? What do you think?
I don't think it is. I know a lot of people end up buying it because they do believe it is, but I've stayed away.
Plain yogurt is healthy.
Yeah.
Okay, plain yogurt has 7 grams of sugar, and it's all lactose, milk sugar. No problem. Yogurt is sour milk.
Yeah.
The only difference between yogurt and the milk that sours in your refrigerator is that for yogurt, you get to choose the bacteria that does the souring. That's it. That's the difference. In Europe, they know this. So what do? They eat plain yogurt, and then they throw pieces of fruit in to try to cut the sourness.
Yeah.
Only in America would yogurt be dessert.
Would be sweet.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you look at a plain yogurt, it's 7 grams of sugar. If you look at a pomegranate yogurt, it's 19 grams of sugar. So that means 12 grams of added sugar specifically for that food. And the question is, why? Well, the answer is easy. Makes it sweet. But did you know that when you're eating a pomegranate yogurt, you're really eating a plain yogurt plus a bowl of Cap'n Crunch?
Yeah.
You still think it's healthy?
No.
Well, that's what you're doing.
The government recommends no more than 40 grams of sugar a day.
Well, actually, the government doesn't recommend anything of the sort. The American Heart Association
40 grams
says somewhere between 35 and 40 grams, 6 teaspoons for women, 9 teaspoons for men, 4 teaspoons for children. And that came out in 2009, and I was a co-author of that scientific statement. It was in circulation 2009. Well, get this. If your kid is in the National School Breakfast Program, which is 25% of children in America today, the standard breakfast is a bowl of Fruit Loops and a glass of orange juice.
Yep.
Well, that's 11 teaspoons of added sugar. That is almost 3 times the allotment for a kid in a day, and it's just breakfast.
Yeah.
You haven't even started yet. And it's been shown, at least association-wise, not causative, we're still working on the causation, but the association between sugar and behavior problems has been made. And actually, the association between sugar and violence has been made. So you think this is a really good thing for kids to be doing first thing in the morning, getting their sugar fix and getting their entire allotment before they ever, you know, get to class? You know, this is a friggin' disaster.
Well, speaking of school breakfasts, and maybe probably school lunches as well, I mean, this you link this to the war on poverty.
Absolutely, of course. Why? Because this is what is available in lower socioeconomic status neighborhoods. You know, the concept of food deserts.
Yeah.
Fact is, really, all they have is convenience food. And convenience food is very high in sugar because, number one, it acts as a preservative, and number two, it gets them to buy it. So this is a problem. This is the gift that keeps on
and
giving.
And it keeps it cheap.
Absolutely. Well, that's what this is all about.
Yeah.
This all started back in the early 1970s when Richard Nixon, recognizing that fluctuating food prices caused political unrest, told his agriculture secretary, Earl Rusty Butz, love that name, that he wanted sugar off the political table as an issue for presidential elections. And so Butts went to the agriculture sector. He went to the farmers. And he said three things in 1971. And here were the three things. He said, row to row, furrow to furrow, get bigger, get out. Make food cheap. That was the goal. And they did. They did. By changing from food to nutrients. This is what Michael Pollan talks about in his books as well. The concept that, you know, you can basically dial up and dial down nutrition, you know, based on, you know, some sort of lever that, you know, lets a certain amount in, and then you can turn it into pseudo food, which, you know, for lack of a better word, we could call breakfast cereal.
Right.
This is basically the concept of nutrition by the numbers. And that's what the food industry has been practicing, because that is dirt cheap. Once they manufacture the nutrients, it is really cheap, and they can sell it at high profit. And the more sugar they put in, the more they sell, because the more we want it, the more we buy, because of the dependence and reward phenomenon. So this has been a juggernaut for the food industry. Prior to 1975, the annual profit margin of the food industry was 1% per year. Well, the annual increase in population was 1% per year. In other words, the food industry made money by selling the same amount of food to more people. Since 1975, the annual profit margin of the food industry is 5% per year. And if anything, our rate of births has gone down, right? Less teen pregnancy, you know, more people, you know, not having big families for socioeconomic reasons. Well, if their profit margin's gone up by 5% per year, that means they're selling more food to the same number of people. And the reason is because they figured out how to beat our satiety system.
Sugar.
It's called sugar.
Yeah. You talked about yogurt. Another interesting example is Gatorade.
Absolutely. Same thing.
People drink Gatorade today thinking it's good for them.
Absolutely. I mean, look, question is, why? I mean, what's in it? Why did they do that?
I heard electrolytes. This is what I always hear to replenish electrolytes after a good workout.
If you are an elite athlete, okay, if you're a member of the Cal Berkeley football team and you're out on the gridiron for 3 hours at a time or more, okay, I have nothing against a sports drink. That is fine. Hmm. But think about Gatorade for a moment. 1965, Dr. Robert Cade invented and patented Gatorade. What was it? It was glucose, sodium, potassium, and water. It was an oral rehydration solution. It's the same thing we give cholera victims in India. And it worked through the same mechanism. It allowed for rehydration because the glucose allowed for the brush border of the intestine to absorb the sodium so that you could replete plasma volume. And it made perfect sense. Did you ever taste the original Gatorade? Well, I did.
But I remember being a kid and not being a fan of it.
It tasted like tiger pee. Okay? It was horrible. And the reason is because glucose isn't very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay? 1992. Gatorade had been acquired by Quaker Oats, and Quaker Oats was acquired by Pepsi-Cola. And they said, how? Two ways. Michael Jordan and high fructose corn syrup.
High fructose corn syrup. Is that worse than if it was just sugar?
No. Basically the same.
It's the same.
All the metabolic studies that pit HFCS against sugar basically show no metabolic difference. They're equally bad. Now, having said that, there are some studies that say that some sodas off the shelf might be 65% fructose instead of 55. And if that's true, then it might be worse, but that hasn't been shown yet. And my colleague, Dr. Richard Johnson, who's head of nephrology at the University of Colorado, has some data in animals that suggests that it's worse. But we don't have data in humans yet that supports that. So I'm not willing to take a stand that HFCS is worse than sugar, at least not today.
Something else that I've seen and began our conversation, I was talking about what's going on with the fight over a soda tax. And it's easy to say soda tax, but it's actually something directed more towards sugary beverages. I see a lot of people drinking vitamin water.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same issue.
I've heard it's just you basically take a, it's like taking a vitamin with a Coke. Or a soda.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's a little bit lower in terms of concentration. It's 50 calories per container instead of, you know, 150 calories per container. So it's a little bit lower, but I mean, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know, do you need that? You don't need that. It is just a marketing tool, just like all the others.
When I was a kid, I did drink a soda a day. I was a fat kid.
Well, I'm not going to tell you that that was the reason. Here's the problem, Jeff. People think it's about obesity. I'm here to tell you it's not. If it's about obesity, food industry wins. It's not about obesity. Obesity
Why does the food industry win?
Two reasons. Number one, there are a lot of causes of obesity. And sugar is just one of many. In fact, it's a minor cause. Meta-analyses of studies looking at how much weight gain is precipitated by changing the sugar in the diet suggests that maybe only about 10% of weight gain is due to sugar.
Mm-hmm.
The top two items in the food supply that cause weight gain, potato chips and french fries. I totally agree. Fat and carbohydrate at the same time, total disaster. Sugar-sweetened beverages, desserts, distant third. So if the goal were get the calories down, get the weight down, we ought to be arguing about potato chips and french fries. But it's not about obesity. It really never was. You don't die of obesity. There's no obesity on death certificates. You die of the diseases that travel with obesity, called metabolic syndrome.
Travel with, but are not caused by?
Well, they are associated with. They may or may not be caused by. Here's the problem. The diseases we're talking about, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, lipid problems, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and dementia. Those are the diseases. And that is 75% of the healthcare budget, those diseases. Here's the nugget of truth that the food industry doesn't want you to know. America is 30% obese, 70% normal weight. So that's a lot of people who are obese. And of those people who are obese, 80% of the 30% are ill from their obesity. 80% of 30%, that's 57 million people. And the standard mantra is that it's those 57 million people who are breaking the medical bank. It's those 57 million people who have to get their act together. It's those 57 million people who have the problem, and if they would only just diet and exercise, we could solve this problem. I got a word for that. It's French. And I'm sure you're going to bleep it out. It's called... It's not true.
We will bleep that part out.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. They say, don't say that on the radio. It's not true. It's just not true. Here's why. Yes, 80% of obese people are metabolically ill. I don't argue that. That means 20% of obese people are not.
Mm-hmm.
20% of obese people...
So it differentiates them from those who are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Those people will live a completely normal life, die at a completely normal age, not cost the taxpayer a dime. They're just fat. Conversely, 40% of the normal weight population have the same metabolic disturbances, the same metabolic diseases as do the obese. They get type 2 diabetes. They get dyslipidemia. They get hypertension. They get cardiovascular disease. They get cancer. They get dementia. Yeah, at a slightly lower rate, but there's a whole lot more of them. So when you do the math on it, that's 67 million compared to the 57 who are obese and sick. You got 67 million who are normal weight and sick. And they don't even know they have a problem. And their doctor says, well, your normal weight, don't worry about it. The fact is, they're costing more than the sick obese are.
Yep.
And so when you add the two together, that's 124 million. That's more than half the U.S. population. So if normal weight people can get the same diseases as the obese, well, you know what? Then it can't be a behavior, can it?
Right.
Because it's not about gluttony and sloth anymore, is it? It wasn't about behavior. It's not about behavior. This is an exposure.
We've done a number of shows about the food industry and always looking at fat and salt. And with those shows, it reminds me when I think of the food industry of the cigarette industry,
mm-hmm.
Feeding people things that are going to keep them hooked
yep.
on it for profit.
Yep. Indeed.
Same thing with sugar?
Absolutely. Just take a look at the most recent scheme of the food industry. They have touted, and they've partnered with Michelle Obama, Campaign for the Healthy Future. They have reduced the number of calories in the American food supply by 6 trillion. They've gone from 60 trillion calories to 54 trillion calories produced per year. And that sounds fantastic. And they are patting themselves on the back.
Calories. I mean, is that
garbage.
The idea?
Or? Again, the French word.
Yeah.
Absolute ridiculousness. Why? Very simple. What were the calories they removed? Fat.
Fat.
They removed the fat.
Yeah.
If you look at the products, pre and post, they're down on calories by, say, 10 calories each, you know, thing. So 150 calories.
So we greatly reduced the amount of fat in our food.
But the sugar stayed exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And that's on purpose. And that's the problem. If a calorie were a calorie, then they could pat themselves on the back. But I've already shown you a calorie is not a calorie. And that's the point. And if the calories are not if it matters where the calories come from, then we should be trying to reduce the calories that come from the problematic foodstuffs, the refined carbohydrate and the sugar, because that's driving the insulin, and the insulin's what's driving both the weight gain and the chronic metabolic disease. And that's not what they're doing. And that's the point.
Of course, there are always competing studies out there, and I read that if you just look at your own Wikipedia page, which you can't fully
the food industry
controlled by yourself, they made your Wikipedia
food industry
page.
Did that. Yep, the food industry did that.
And that 2/3 of the study that they cite, and when you go to the controversy part of it,
of course.
You see studies that contradict what you were saying.
You know, I don't really give a damn.
Yeah.
I really don't. Okay, the Wikipedia page is the Wikipedia page. It's not me.
That must be frustrating, though.
I don't care. I really don't care. To be honest with you, if I cared, I'd hire somebody to go fix it. I don't need to. Here's the issue. A paper just came out in Plus Med a month and a half ago by Rez Bastrolo et al. And what they did was they did a meta-analysis of meta-analyses on sugared sweetened beverages and weight gain. There were 18 studies that they were able to cite. 6 funded by the food industry and 12 funded through independent sources. Of the 6 funded by the food industry, 5 showed no significant effect of sugar sweetened beverages on weight gain. 5 out of 6 said no effect. If you looked at the 12 that were independently funded, 10 out of the 12 showed a significant effect. Bottom line, the food industry pays for studies to exonerate them. They don't pay for unbiased science. It's about the unbiased science. And we at UCSF are into the unbiased science. I am into the unbiased science. The problem is when you read a paper, instead of reading the abstract, instead of reading the conclusion, which is what everybody does, the first thing you have to read is the funding source to figure out whether or not you can even trust it or not.
Mm-hmm.
This is a war. This is a war.
Well, you're threatening their profits, or at least your study.
Well, you see, the thing is, I don't want to threaten their profits.
Yeah.
Okay? They don't care what they sell, as long as they sell.
Right.
They really don't care what they sell. They've told me so, directly. They said, we don't care what we sell. We just can't lose money.
Yeah.
Because they have Wall Street profits and quarterly reports and stockholders and blah, blah, blah. And that's how they decide, the stockholders decide who keeps, the executive jobs, et cetera. So they can't go against the stockholders.
Right.
Their job is to make money, and they will make money any way they can. But if they could make money selling healthy stuff, they would do it.
Yeah.
They could.
But not as much. They could.
They could. But we would need a new food business model, where they would be rewarded for quality, not quantity. Right now, they're rewarded for quantity because of Nixon and Butts.
Mm.
So we have to roll that back.
Towards nutritional.
Food.
Does it become in it?
Toward food.
Right. But then can low-income folks afford it?
They can be subsidized. Can be differentially subsidized. You could subsidize broccoli if you wanted to.
Yeah.
We've chosen not to. And now we've got this big behemoth, the Farm Bill, that's been, It's now 80 years old, from 1933, it's now 80 years old, and nothing's happened to it. The Farm Bill was created in 1933 because of two things.
Yeah.
The Dust Bowl and starvation.
Yeah.
Okay? We had farmers who were basically couldn't grow anything because of the Dust Bowl, and we had a destitute population. It was the Depression too,
so it was like the double hit of subsidies and food stamps.
So we needed storable food. We needed food that you could put in a silo and ship around. Corn and soy. And the problem is, once the Dust Bowl and the Depression ended, the subsidies should have ended. But they didn't. It made sense at the time. It doesn't make sense now.
And I guess, what, Pepsi Company and Coca-Cola see you as public enemy number one?
No, I'm only public enemy number five, but I'm trying to work my way up.
Are you? but Coke has funded a number of studies that you're mentioning.
Absolutely. Of course they have. Yeah. Yes, and one of my nemeses in Toronto, Dr. John Sievenpiper, you know, talks very casually about the fact that he takes money from Coke. He says, but it doesn't influence the data. The fact of the matter is, his data actually support my position. It's just that he spins it to support theirs.
To support theirs.
Yep.
And that's what they do. You have written a cookbook.
I have.
Again, it's called The Fat Chance Cookbook. Do you have any sugar in it at all?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In the desserts. I mean, you know, bottom line is a little is okay. A lot is not. Sugar, a dessert used to be a treat. It used to be once a week. Now it's once a meal. So if you want to make an apple pie once a week, hey, go for it. And we have not full sugar recipes. We have reduced sugar recipes. My wife is Norwegian. She bakes for therapy. I can't stop her. But she has learned that she can bake with cookies or cakes with 1/3 less sugar. And not only do they come out equivalent in terms of texture, but they actually taste better because you can taste the chocolate, you can taste the nuts, you can taste the oatmeal. And then we give away like a bunch, you know, to the neighbors and stuff. And she does it, you know, once a week, once every 2 weeks. We never buy store-bought cookies, okay? I would be a fool to bring home store-bought cookies. The point is, if you make it a treat, if you make it something worth looking forward to, you can do that. That's not a problem. I am not a food Nazi. You know, sugar has a place. The problem is right now it has too much of a place.
Too much of a place. What about artificial sweeteners?
So artificial sweeteners are very complicated. I'll try to make it brief, but it's not a brief topic.
Yeah.
We don't know. That's the short answer. We don't know. Officially, we don't know. And I don't know. And there's a reason we don't know. Not because I don't know, but because we don't have the data. The data don't exist. Why don't the data exist? I'll tell you why. There's something called pharmacokinetics. There's something called pharmacodynamics. They're not the same. Pharmacokinetics is what your body does to a drug. Pharmacodynamics is what a drug does to your body. They are not the same. We have all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because the FDA demands those because that's in their charter. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act of 1938. Their job is to assess acute toxicity, whether you're going to keel over and die from any given foodstuff.
Right.
Okay? That's their job. So we have all the pharmacokinetics because that tells you about acute toxicity. The food industry has to produce those in order to get their sweetener on the market. But the FDA does not ask for pharmacodynamic studies because that's about chronic toxicity, and that's not in their charter. So they don't ask for those. Food industry says, well, why should we do those studies? They're expensive, they take a lot of people, and they can't help ourselves. They can only hurt them. We're not going to do them.
Yeah, I really couldn't help them.
No. And then the NIH says, hey, it's the food industry's compound, it's the food industry's job. Let them pay for it. So we got an FDA who doesn't ask for it, we got a food industry who won't do it, and we got an NIH who won't pay for it. No data.
There it is.
Second problem. You put something sweet on the tongue. Message goes from the tongue to the brain, says, sugar bolus is coming, get ready to release the insulin. Brain sends a message via the vagus nerve to the pancreas. Make vesicles and get ready to release them when the sugar bolus hits and the blood sugar goes up. But then the blood sugar doesn't go up because it was a diet sweetener.
But your body still responds.
So the question is, what is the pancreas?
Responding to it, or I mean, that's the question, I suppose.
That's the question.
It could be, yeah.
The question is, what does the pancreas do? Does it go, oh man, I was waiting for that sugar, it never came, I guess I'll wait till tomorrow?
Yeah.
Or does it go, you know, I got all these vesicles stored up, I got to go find some calories to work on, and you end up overeating instead. Huh. We don't even know that. There was a paper that came out last year.
Could we be producing insulin?
What this study showed, that I'm about to tell you about. From Yanina Papino from Washington University, St. Louis, who was in diabetes care last year. She took 17 morbidly obese adults and did glucose tolerance testing on them twice, a week apart. One with a diet soda pretreatment, one without. And the question is, what did the insulin do? And it turned out with the diet soda pretreatment, the patients released 20% more insulin for the same amount of calories and the same amount of blood sugar rise. So that would suggest that your body will still make insulin to the sweet taste via the brain instead of via the blood sugar. And that would argue that diet sweeteners would be a problem as well.
But we don't know for sure.
But we don't know for sure.
Robert Lustig, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, Robert Lustig has been our guest, professor of pediatrics and endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco, where he is also director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program. He's the president of the Institute for Responsible Nutrition. You can find more about the Institute for Responsible Nutrition online at responsiblefoods.org. He's also the author of a number of books, including Fat Chance, Sugar Has 56 Names, and his latest, a cookbook, The Fat Chance Cookbook. And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez, Laura Privis, and Eileen Alfandari. I'm Mitch Chesrich. Thanks for listening.
Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. That was a show that we carry on our HD3 channel, The Source. It's Letters and Politics. Mitch Chesrich is the host, and the show airs at 6 o'clock on weeknights on WMNF's HD3, and you can hear it just by going to WMNF.org and /listen, and you'll find a way to listen to a show like that. We're going to continue with the theme of health and nutrition, even though our good friend Eve Prang Plews has passed away. We're going to continue with that theme every other Monday, alternating with John Butts. We'll have a different show next week. Let us know what you thought of today's show. You can email us here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org. Coming up next, we're going to hear Florida This Week. And before we do that, though, we'll hear the NPR News. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. And here's some music from Bruce Springsteen. Take us up the news.
Everybody's got a hungry heart.
This is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. Stay tuned for the news.